you find yourself drawn to the more unusual and offbeat stories throughout history? Sure, millions of people like keeping up with the Kardashians or wondering about the secret meaning in Taylor Swift's latest song, but there's so much to cover beyond that space. In fact, it's probably a good summary of humans in general. If there's something strange that could happen, then, well, someone will probably make that thing happen. Mark Hartzman has that innate interest in the weird, unique stories that have built up over the years. He's written about ghosts, Mars, Oliver Cromwell's embalmed head, and weird things on eBay, just to name a few. His latest book, We Are Not Alone, The Extraordinary History of UFOs and Aliens Invading Our Hopes, Fears, and Fantasies, looks into the vast universe of aliens and extraterrestrials, and there's been a lot that's out of this world. Hey, look at me making some wordplay. Mark's chatting about where the term flying saucer came from, a few lesser-known stories, and his top alien movies and TV shows. I'm Joey Held, this is Good People Cool Things, and here's my conversation with Mark Hartzman. Can you give us your name and your elevator pitch, but also the type of elevator that we're riding on?
Yeah, hi, this is Mark Hartzman. I'm an author. I write about a lot of weird history. I love all the stranger pages of the past. So my most recent book is called We Are Not Alone, The Extraordinary History of UFOs and Aliens Invading Our Hopes, Fears, and Fantasies from Quirk Books. I've also written about ghosts, Mars, Oliver Cromwell's embalmed head, sideshow performers, lots of fun, fascinating, strange things. I love it all. And that's my elevator pitch. If I'm on an elevator, it would be a Wonkavator, because I like going in all different directions with everything. So keeps things much more fun.
Hopefully not like the Scottish Wonka of just a disappointment left and right. If you're familiar with that story, this is one of my favorite 2024 stories. Is I don't even remember who it was, but someone in Scotland set up this Willy Wonka interactive immersive experience, and then it was just a couple of like hand drawn, like poorly designed posters almost on the wall, and people, you know, shelled out like $50 to go visit this thing that was just the most disappointing.
I miss that. That's crazy.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That sounds so un-Wonka like.
I know. Clearly not officially licensed or anything.
Did you at least like lick the pictures and taste something, or
maybe just bitter disappointment?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, just the realization that you've been had.
That's funny.
Now you have just a natural curiosity and like inclination towards the weird things, but specifically for UFOs and aliens, was there a certain story that kind of got you into this space and you're like, I need to write a book about this?
Sort of. Yeah. I mean, I've always kind of been fascinated by UFOs and aliens. You know, it's just one of those topics as a kid. I think lots of people are fascinated by it, right? But it was actually a story I came across that got me writing the book on Mars called The Big Book of Mars a few years ago. And that story that really pulled me into that topic was about a Martian woman in 1926 sending telepathic communications to a lawyer in London. Of course, this is what he claimed. And then he worked with the Postal Service in London had the largest and most powerful radio tower, the Rugby radio tower in the world at that time. So he was trying to send telegrams to Mars when Mars was in opposition, meaning its closest point to Earth in its orbit, like 35 million miles away or so. You know, obviously that didn't work. No Martians receive it, but this was getting headlines across the world about this, experiment, this attempt. There was still a lot of belief in the potential for intelligent life on Mars at that point. So that story was pretty fascinating. As I started writing The Big Book of Mars, which got into much more beliefs about Martians and NASA lore and much, much more about that planet, I started writing a little bit about UFOs because in the late 40s, when the big flying saucer craze really hit in 1947 after Kenneth Arnold's sighting over Mount Rainier in Washington, and that's when the term flying saucer became a thing, I kind of got up to that point, and then there were a few explanations where people thought that some of these UFOs might be coming from Mars. Again, they were still believed that there could be some Martians. And some of these were coming from military commanders who saw something with their teams overhead. They thought, you know, they claimed to have seen UFOs and thought it might be piloted by Martians. And part of the thinking then was that, you know, this was coming off of World War II in the beginning of the atomic age, Cold War. So there was a lot of belief that, you know, our nuclear weapons, are these going to disturb our neighbors, you know, our planetary neighbors? And are we going to not only destroy ourselves, but the solar system? So there was thought that maybe the Martians were coming here to warn us, or, you know, warn us to you know, be careful with the atomic age, not to mess things up for them. You know, so these were some of the thoughts going around back then. So that was just kind of touching on the UFO phenomena in that book. But obviously, there's so much more. So I want to dive in with another book entirely devoted to the topic. So that's where We Are Not Alone really comes in.
Is there a particular story or event in the book that you find particularly interesting that, you know, isn't as popular or isn't as well known?
Oh, there's many. well, I'll give one quick example that's not too well known, I don't think, at least. One of them that is well known is the Phoenix Lights from 1997, where about 20,000 people saw this triangular UFO flying overhead over Phoenix and most of Arizona, silently, large object. So many witnesses saw this. When you have those mass sightings, it gets extra curious to me. But about 20 years before that, there was another sighting that was somewhat similar in North Carolina in Lumberton. And a friend of mine witnessed this. His name is Lee Spiegel. He sadly passed away last August, but he was a journalist who'd studied the UFO phenomena since the 70s. And he had this experience where he was working with CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies, which was started by Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And Hynek was the chief investigator, scientific investigator for Project Blue Book from the late 40s to 1969 when that ended. So Hynek was getting these reports in through CUFOS about this triangular UFO flying over North Carolina, Lumberton, North Carolina. And he sent my friend Lee to go investigate. And so Lee flies down there. He meets up with a police chief. And the reports are still coming in. So he goes out with the police chief and they're driving around looking for this thing. And they're not seeing anything for a while. Thinking like, all right, is this for real? What's going on? And then they see it. They pull off the side of the road and they see this triangular object flying overhead about treetop level high, perfectly silent. And it's Lee, police officer, I think a couple other police officers, maybe a few other witnesses. So a handful of witnesses, not just him on his own. Not 20,000 like Phoenix, but still a number of people, including law enforcement officers. So he says that it's just sitting there overhead. It flashes down a beam of light at his feet and then, you know, tracks that. And then it just flew off perfectly silently and they chased in their police car as far as they could. Eventually they lost it. Another police officer reports seeing the same thing and said how he had like flashed his lights and it flashed back and he flashed twice. It flashed twice back, almost like it's trying to communicate or, you know, mirror what it was doing. And so that was a very strange case. And so Lee looked into it. While he was there, he was investigating what the source could be. You know, could this be a test program with the Air Force, some kind of new technology they were testing? So he contacted the nearby Air Force base. They had nothing that would align with any tests they might be doing or you know, early pilot tests or anything like that that synced up with the timing or the location. So they kind of ruled out that it could be any kind of Air Force testing. And nothing else ever came out of it. You know, he wrote up a report for Hynek. No one ever found out like what this thing might be. That was one of those weird cases completely left unknown to this day. But it was especially interesting just coming from someone who I know. You know, it's one thing to hear stories. You never know what people might be like when you're hearing stories from them or, you know, reading stories, I should say, from other sources. But when you know someone personally, it's hard to imagine he's just making this whole thing up or that the other people around him were making the whole thing up together. So I found that case particularly interesting.
Does Lee have a theory of where or, you know, have a guess of like where whatever that was came from?
I don't think he had a specific guess. I think he felt it was extraterrestrial. But from where exactly, like who's to say any of these things, you know, what would we know? But you know, he would always like to say, and you hear this argument a lot, that, you know, if you look back at the last 100 years, how far along we've come in technology. So if another civilization is 500 years ahead of us, who's to say they haven't figured out how to traverse the, you know, immense distance between our planet and something else from another star system? Light years are kind of hard to imagine how you could. I mean, one light year is about 6 trillion miles. It's kind of hard to imagine how we could in a lifetime ever go 6 trillion miles. let alone like hundreds of light years, you know, but, you know, but yeah, who's to say that we won't learn more about physics and figure out another way to actually make that possible. So yeah,
it's going to be my comeback. Curious. Next time someone complains about driving across Texas, I'll be like, at least it's not a light year.
Yeah. Not that far. Could be worse.
I want to go back to, you mentioned where the term flying saucer came from. I'm realizing, like, I don't know that. Is it just because it looks like a tea saucer in the air, or is there more to the name?
So Kenneth Arnold, he was this pilot who saw these 9 flying discs over Mount Rainier in Washington. This was in June 24th, 1947. And so he's flying and he sees these things, and when he told people about when he landed, he described them as like discs or like saucers skipping across a lake. As if you know, were like throwing stones and skipping them across the lake. And so one of the reporters, he was like kind of mobbed by the media at this point because word had spread about his sighting. And so one of the reporters heard that comment from him and dubbed the term flying saucer. So that's where it came from. And that stuck. As I said in our book, in We Are Not Alone, our skies and our lexicon has never been the same since then.
I love it. And one of the other things that I saw in prepping for this is that NASA is shifting its terminology from UFO to UPA or UAP.
Yeah.
For folks who, I mean, this was news to me. So what does UAP stand for and why is this shift happening?
So UAP stands for, well, kind of two things now, unidentified aerial phenomena, but now they're also saying unidentified anomalous phenomena. And so it's interesting because UFO actually came about to replace flying saucer because flying saucer became had such a stigma to it with like just nutty people seeing aliens, right? So there were just thousands of reports at this time. And so then it became UFO. And of course, UFO became the same thing, had a huge stigma applied to it. So when the government started taking things a bit more seriously in the past several years, and NASA started taking more of a serious interest as well, they've shifted that terminology to UAP, really, again, just to kind of separate themselves from that stigma, because that stigma really did push scientific research away from that subject for so long, which is really a shame because, you know, who knows what we might know now had they been collecting more data, studying more seriously back then, which they're finally starting to do now, especially with, you know, Avi Loeb's Galileo Project, the Harvard professor, who's the guy who basically said that Oumuamua, the object that flew through the solar system, the interstellar object that flew through the solar system in 2017, he believes is extraterrestrial nature, extraterrestrial technology. So he's got scientists working with him now. He's got funding, private funding, to actually look into collecting real data and trying to figure something out, find some answers for us, which is amazing.
Yeah, that's super cool. Well, I'm excited to see what comes from that.
Yeah.
As someone who is currently right now trying to edit down a journalism piece that I'm doing to about half its current length, I'm wondering, when you were putting this book together, was there anything that you had in there but then you're like, you know, doesn't really like fit with everything else, or it didn't make the cut for whatever reason?
Yeah. there's so much. I kind of blew past my word count. I warned my editor. I'm like, I'm going a little past. You know, I think I ended up with about 20,000 words more than they asked me to deliver, and I think I kind of met them in the middle with the edits. But I did have initially had a first chapter that was all about the ancient alien theories. I won't say like not like the show, but kind of looking into some of those beliefs. Hmm. You know, looking back into whether it's petroglyphs or, you know, whether artifacts might be that might represent or some people think might be alien in nature, even from the Bible as well. So I had a lot on that, and we ended up cutting that. But I did salvage a few of the pieces from that, kind of put it throughout the book in terms of like just sidebars related to other topics. Cause I didn't want to lose it entirely, but I did go a lot deeper into that early on. In one section that I did lose and we did not salvage at all, was a pretty interesting case from 1896 and 97, which was called the Great Airship, the Great Airships of 1896 and 1897. That's basically what it's called. So just think back for a second. But basically, they started seeing these strange airships, starting in like California, and then just spreading across the country, and seeing people talking on them, waving on them from them. And these reports are amazing. And certainly, there's lots of people saying, "Oh, I invented this flying, you know, airship." This was like, you know, early, you know, before the Wright brothers. There were some aerial, like, you know, there were balloons and things like that, but there weren't like these kind of airships really just yet. There were some that were unmanned, but this was kind of at that weird point where, like, well, what exactly is this? No one really came up with a good answer for what these things were. Some people had, you know, came up with stories, but they ended up being hoaxes. But yeah, these stories spread all across for months. And there was one story that was pretty interesting where one of them crashed actually in Texas. And they claimed it was a Martian pilot, which again aligns with a lot of the Martian beliefs of that era. That's right around when War of the Worlds was being, you know, written by H.G. Wells. And so I think to this day, I think there's still a burial marker there in this town. I think it's Aurora, Texas, where they say the Martian pilot was downed. And I love that that actually is, it's 50 years, exactly 50 years before the Roswell incident. So it's almost like a little precursor, because that's become a bit of a tourist destination now to see this this crashed alien. And obviously 50 years later, on a much grander scale, you have that in Roswell.
Oh, that's wild. I like that. I like that. I got to go make a road trip then, I guess, to Aurora.
Yeah, there's your drive.
Yeah, there we go. one light year away.
Yeah.
A question I always like to ask is a question you wish you were asked more frequently. And I don't know the answer to this, so I'm excited to hear about it. Who were the contactees in the 1950s?
So someone who loves, like, obviously the weirder side of all of this, as if the whole thing isn't weird to begin with. But the contactees were this group in the 1950s who claimed to have made contact with aliens, usually Venusians. And the Venusians were usually, you know, very described as very beautiful humanoids. So basically looked like to us, but better. Everything was always better outside of Earth, right? So these people, they were very vocal about these experiences. They wrote lots of books. One of my favorite titles is Inside the Spaceships by George Adamski, who was probably the most vocal of all of them. And he claimed to have been a Venusian in 1952, and then eventually was able to fly on that Venusian scout ship up to the mothership, and then met with Martians and someone from Saturn and flew on their ships. And, you know, he just recounts all these different experiences he had. And he would go on lectures. All these guys would go on lectures, hold conventions. And, you know, again, considering that at that time, again, Cold War era, atomic age, mostly they were saying that these aliens were coming with messages of peace and warning us about the atomic age. So that was kind of a good message that they had to spread. But the stories were just so quirky and odd, you know, these meetings they had. And they were trying to, like, it almost felt like they were one-upping each other. You know, another one had Daniel W. Fry had said that he flew in a spaceship in 1950, unmanned, but flew from the White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico to New York City and back in 30 minutes at like 8,000 miles per hour, and was communicating with an alien who was controlling the whole thing remotely. So he, you know, he wrote a whole book on that. You had other people who claimed to have married Venusians, had families with Venusians. There's another book where a guy talked about going to the moon, to Mars, and Venus. It's like, you know, you went to Venus. Well, I went to the moon, Mars, and Venus. You know, how can we keep one up in each other? I just got another book about someone who wrote her whole book through messages sent from someone from Jupiter. So this was going on for about a decade. In fact, in 1960, I talked about this and We Are Not Alone, Daniel W. Fry was running on a ticket with another guy, another contactee named Gabriel Green, who ran for president on the space age ticket. So he was running against Nixon and Kennedy in 1960. Obviously, he didn't do well. It didn't last that long, and he dropped out. But there's a great ad I reproduced that was in newspapers with his platform and his messaging and why you should vote for him. He ultimately ended up endorsing Kennedy, which the space people suggested he do. And, you know, Kennedy got us to the moon, so he, you know, he was good pro-space president, obviously. But but their stories are just, I mean, they're very bizarre. They're rather entertaining. At the same time, though, they are the kind of people who help build that stigma around flying saucers and UFOs that they push more serious thought away from it. So it's a weird thing where I love the entertainment value of it. I love the, you know, the messaging is positive overall, but they also did maybe hold back a sort of real serious research into the topic.
Yeah, that does sound like very high entertainment value, but I agree. I think they maybe did a little damage, at least in the long term. You've written about so many different things, and I'm curious, can we get a scoop? What's next? What's the next book?
Yeah, I'm doing a couple books right now. I'm almost done with one of them, which is a history of sword swallowing that I'm writing with a sword swallower who's set many world records in sword swallowing. He's been on America's Got Talent and other Got Talent shows around the world. His name is Dan Meyer. So we're doing a book called To the Hilt, A Sword Swallower's History of Sword Swallowing, which I'm very excited about. There's nothing else like this out there. We've covered more than like 70 sword swallowers from history, and then lots of current sword swallowers still performing today. And then I'm also working on, with my same publisher, Quirk Books, who did We Are Not Alone, I'm doing a book on secret government projects, which, you know, not secret anymore. They've been declassified, but there's a lot of crazy stuff in there. So more stuff on UFOs is one part of it, but there's so much more. I've been writing about the mind control programs of the 50s right now, which is making my mind spin. But my God, there's a lot of crazy stuff. And it's not conspiracy stuff. This is like stuff that actually happened. So that's what I love about this book, is it's not like weird things people think. This is like, no, this is what happened. There's documents about it.
Weird, real things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's been a lot of fun, but yeah, very, very strange stuff. A little kind of, some of it's kind of fun and quirky. Some of it's just creepy and scary.
Do you have a title for it, or still TBD?
Tentatively titled That's Classified.
Nice.
But yeah, we'll
see. Big classified stamp is the cover.
Something like that, I think. Yeah. Yeah. I want to have the cover mostly redacted is my goal.
Excellent. Yeah. And I'm curious, with the sword swallowing, have you attempted, since you've been doing this book, have you tried to swallow a sword?
no desire. In fact, that's in my introduction. That's my first sentence, is I've never swallowed a sword and I have no desire to. I've done the human blockhead routine where you push like a nail through your nose into your head. I've done that.
Oh, yes, yes.
But I do not want to learn sword swallowing. That takes dedication and some guts, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's just not something I've been interested in doing. I'm perfectly happy to write about it. That's
I'm happy to read about it. But yeah, I'm like, kudos to the people who do that. But I echo your opening lines.
It's amazing. And just for anyone listening, it's real. Like, it's amazing that people still, it's usually something people ask me right away. It's like, oh, it's not real though, is it? Like, no, it's definitely real. They absolutely do it.
They're thinking it's just like the angle, put it like to the side of their head.
Or they retract into the handle, is what people commonly think. So a lot of times sword swallowers will have other things they'll swallow without a handle, so that you can see, well, there's nothing. There's no way for that blade to go. So, you know, what are you going to say then? And they'll like stab the sword into like a block of wood just to show like this thing's real as well. But yeah, it's a pretty incredible skill.
There's always haters out there, so I'm glad they can put them in their place. All right, Mark, now you're almost off the hook, but we always like to wrap up with a top three, and I'm curious to hear your top three alien movies and TV shows.
So one of them I just watched again with my daughter, actually. I always love is 2001. Such a great movie. It's over 50 years old, but it holds up so well. It's just so intelligent, the way it goes about everything. And it's a beautiful film. Like, it's art directed just incredibly well. You know, Kubrick knew what he was doing. But just the idea of how aliens kind of bestowed intelligence upon humanity and how that goes through time. And basically you never see the aliens, which I love. You kind of feel their presence a little bit through the monolith, but and the sound. But that's it. Like, it's this amazing alien movie with no aliens, which I kind of love. So that's an incredible film. And I guess another one I love is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is also amazing. And, you know, Spielberg was so interested in UFOs. He actually based one of the characters on J. Allen Hynek, who we talked about earlier, and another researcher, Jacques Vallée. So that's the two main scientists are based on those guys. And Hynek makes a cameo at the end of the movie. But he also took like real stories and kind of integrated some of those stories into the film. So different things that were happening were based on actual accounts of UFO experiences that people had had. So I love how he was really genuine, I think, to the subject matter. And it's just a beautiful story. So I like that one. And then for TV, you know, to me, like one of the greatest TV shows ever still holds up as The Twilight Zone. And my favorite episode is The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. And it's just such a brilliant episode. It actually reminded me of that film that just came out on Netflix, Leave the World. Was it Leave the World Behind? I think.
That sounds right.
Where it's like, oh, if you turn off the power, people are just going to kind of lose it, you know? Yeah. And that's what happens in this episode, which only took him like 25 minutes for the episode. Didn't take 2.5 hours to tell the story. But this episode, basically, the lights go out on the block and the neighbors come out and trying to figure out what's going on. And the kid with reading comic books is like, oh, maybe it's aliens, you know? And then they start wondering and then things start to happen. The aliens like turn the car on. Well, they'll turn lights on at one house. Like, well, why are your lights going on? And they start accusing each other. Like, well, I've seen him out late at night looking at the stars. The guy's like, well, I got insomnia. I just go outside at night. I don't know. And it's like this mob mentality quickly forms, thinking that one of them might be an alien among us. And it's just so well done. And it just, and then basically at the end, you know, the aliens are like, well, that, you know, that was easy. We could just do this one neighborhood at a time and they'll just take care of themselves. We don't have to do anything because their paranoia and mob mentality, they'll wipe themselves out. All we got to do is like flip a couple switches. So it's a pretty interesting comment just on humanity and our own, you know, mentality we deal with each other.
Glad to see that's still probably pretty accurate.
Yeah, it holds up.
Decades later, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Mark, this was fantastic. Thank you for taking the time to chat. If people want to pick up a copy of We Are Not Alone, or better yet, all of your books, where can they find you?
You can find me at markhartzmanbooks.com. It's Mark, M-A-R-C, Hartzman, H-A-R-T-Z-M-A-N. You can find any of these books on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, bookshop.org. Any bookstores should have We Are Not Alone, and hopefully Chasing Ghosts and Big Book of Mars as well. So yeah, you can find me on Instagram at just @MarkHartzman also.
Lovely. And we'll have links in the show notes. Thank you again for taking the time to chat. This was great.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be back.
And of course, we've got to end with a corny joke, as we always do, and a topical one, because I was in the office last week and I always suspected my coworker was a ghost. And then I saw her walk through the door. Get after it today, people. Good People Cool Things is produced in Austin, Texas. If you were a fan of this episode, go ahead and hit that follow button. That helps more people hear the show. You can send me a message, joey@goodpeoplecoolthings.com. Thank you to all of the guests who have been on Good People Cool Things. You can check out all the old episodes via goodpeoplecoolthings.com. As always, thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.